This is Fresh Air. I'm TV critic David Bianculli, starting the second half of the show with what I hope is a helpful guide for your holiday shopping plans. I have a short list of recent DVD releases of TV shows that you might want to give or drop hints to get this year. Let's start with my favorite new box set of 2010. From Shout Factory, it's The Larry Sanders Show, the complete series, containing every episode of the HBO comedy that starred Gary Shandling as a neurotic talk show host. The series was televised from 1992 to 1998 and focused on the behind-the-scenes planning, scheming, and absurdity that goes into putting on a TV talk show. That sensibility extends to the new box set, which includes a ton of behind-the-scenes elements of its own, including a random piece of audio from co-star Rip Torn, who played Larry's foul-mouthed producer, Artie. Torn is recording a list of mild euphemisms meant as substitutions in case the Larry Sanders Show, the real one, ever was syndicated in a milder form. Hearing Torn read the list all at once is as ridiculously funny as the fact that he was asked to record it in the first place.
Miscellaneous Wildline Library, take one.
Crap. Crap. Friggin. 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 Ass. 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 Bullcrap. Bullcrap. Horse hockey. Horse hockey. Hell. Hell. Hell.
Okay.
That's enough. Thank you.
What about this call?
Also in the bonus material are lots of deleted scenes. Most of them richer, longer, and more entertaining than most material stuffed onto DVD sets as extras. In the show's brilliant finale, for example, Jim Carrey stops the show as the celebrity who serenades Larry the way Bette Midler sang to Johnny Carson on his penultimate show. But the DVD extras continue that scene through the pretend commercial break, as Carrey drops his showbiz act and talks frankly to Shandling's Larry and his sidekick Hank, played brilliantly by Jeffrey Tambor.
Can I be honest with you?
Yeah.
I'm here for three good reasons. Last show, big ratings, movie coming out. Bim, bam, boom. Otherwise, I'll be sitting home watching Nightline.
As usual.
There's two...
You didn't mention anything about the movie.
What?
You didn't say anything about the movie.
I didn't mention the Truman Show?
No.
Oh, my God.
You didn't say anything, did he, about
no.
Truman Show?
Oh, my God.
I don't think so.
Oh, I don't believe this.
I don't think
Do I have
did.
A clip, too?
Huh? There was a clip. Yeah, but you didn't bring it up.
See, that's your fault. As a host, you should have led me in that direction. Even Jon Stewart can set up a friggin' clip.
Well, that is not necessary. You know what? Why don't you stay and do another segment? And then I'll show the clip.
Nah, shot my wad.
Can I say something? Can I say something? Cable guy, underrated.
Well, thank you very much, Henry. You ever get tired of kissing ass? You know, you're the most talented person on this show. I've always believed that. You have something very special, and yet you squander it here. Well, you know, this show going off the air could be a blessing in disguise for you.
You think so?
Nope.
Ned?
Good luck.
Another new complete set from Fox Home Entertainment is recommended not because most of it is new to DVD, but because it is complete. It's 24, the complete series, and comes out December 14th. Just in time to give or get all 8 seasons of Jack Bauer's Very Bad Days. It's a huge set and hugely expensive. But for rabid fans of 24, it's the ultimate package, at least until the movie comes out. Another complete series, which has been out for 2 years on DVD, but only now has been released on Blu-ray, is HBO's Deadwood, which ran from 2004 to 2006. It should have run for at least 2 years longer, which even series creator David Milch now admits on the DVD extras. Giving a guided tour of the mammoth, realistic, now deserted Deadwood set, he says, "I find all of this infinitely depressing." But Deadwood is one of the best TV drama series ever made, And on Blu-ray, the dirt and grit of Deadwood seems even dirtier and grittier. It looks simply astounding. Ian McShane, Keith Carradine, Molly Parker, and the rest are truly amazing as residents of an outlaw western mining town. To me, Deadwood is as good and as infinitely rewatchable as The Wire. And that's as high as my praise gets. Another impressive new Blu-ray release is an HBO miniseries, The Pacific, the companion drama to Band of Brothers. On Blu-ray, the battle scenes in The Pacific are both jaw-dropping and teeth-rattling. And there's a lot of enhanced video on the Blu-ray, where you can be fed facts and stories instantly about the drama as you watch it. But don't do that the first time you watch it, or the accompanying annotations will spoil a lot of the dramatic surprises. It's hard to imagine anyone being unhappy with at least one of these sets. But since they all come with rather hefty price tags, I thought I'd end with recommendations for two smaller, less expensive new releases that make for great gifts. For any lover of musicals, there's Evening Primrose, the first time on DVD release of Stephen Sondheim's 1966 made-for-TV musical. It stars Tony Perkins as a poet who avoids rent in New York by hiding illegally in a department store and coming out only at night, along with other people who had the same idea. It's strange and a bit dark, but it's also wonderful. And finally, for the very young people on your list, or the old ones who are young at heart, there's another vintage TV musical treat. It's Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol, the 1962 holiday special with Jim Backus as Ebenezer Scrooge. The classic media release gives you both a Blu-ray and a regular DVD for one low price. The animation is so static that, to be honest, Blu-ray does nothing for it. But the music is by Julie Stein and Bob Merrill, who at the time were collaborating on Funny Girl. It's the first animated Christmas special ever made for television, and there's something about it, after nearly 50 years, that's positively delicious. Maybe it's Tiny Tim singing about razzleberry dressing. But I've road-tested it on today's young kids, and it still delights. Just like any of these DVDs would.
Will we have a gander and some razzleberry dressing?
Oh, razzleberry dressing would be nice.
Will we have a pudding made of liver while we're guessing?
Or maybe razzleberry dressing twice.
We haven't had a hen since I can tell you when. We love a hen again
with razzleberry dressing.
We've been so awful good,
from me down to the baby,
and we're not made of wood
or razzleberry gravy.
Coming up, new developments regarding an old controversy. This is Fresh Air.
The demand for dolls, though, is up.
She totally gets me. We're friends for all time, my American girl. Hey.
It's been a good year for dolls, with sales up 12% over last year, according to market research firm NPD Group. And that's not even counting year-end holiday sales. Consumers have so far spent more than $1.5 billion on dolls and doll accessories. But it's not just the doll market that's growing.
Sparkle lights, princesses, Barbie girl.
Barbie sparkle lights, princess dolls light up.
Some of the new personalities on the doll shelf make Barbie seem downright puny. Dolls have gotten bigger in size. We ask reporter Ann Zimmerman into our studio to find out more about this. She covers the doll industry for the Wall Street Journal.
A fashion doll, typically fashioned like a Barbie doll, they're about 11 inches. And now these manufacturers are making dolls from 18 to 21 inches. There's the popular Disney princesses, Ariel, Tiana. They're now 18 inches tall. There's a line of private label dolls that Toys R Us has come out with, exclusive to them, called Journey Dolls, again, 18 inches tall.
Has something changed to make manufacturers do this?
I think about 10 years ago, manufacturers noticed that girls were starting to, what they call, age out of dolls at a younger age. They were giving them up at around age 6. Barbie started appealing to younger and younger girls. Disney came out with a line of their princesses, and that appealed to younger girls, so they came out with a line of Barbie princesses to compete. So girls were aging out of them. I think also manufacturers looked at American Girl doll. These are 18-inch dolls, very expensive, $100. So they did very, very well during the recession. While sale of toys weren't great, American Girl dolls went up by 7% in 2008, which is amazing. So I think manufacturers looked at that and said, this has staying power.
Although, if you go to Amazon.com toy section and you sort of get down to dolls, it looks like at least there Barbie and Barbie accessories dominate the bestseller list.
Absolutely. Barbie is still the undisputed queen of the doll aisle, but her growth has slowed.
Has anybody a theory on why girls gave up dolls at a younger age and also what they're doing instead of playing with dolls?
What they left for? They left for computer-based games and social media sites.
So in a way, interacting with real people, but not in a face-to-face way.
Right. Exactly.
Anne, thanks very much for talking with us again.
Thank you.
Anne Zimmerman is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal.
It takes only about 2 seconds of this. Or possibly 3 seconds of this. And maybe another 4 seconds of this. To know that you are positively not in Kansas anymore. No, these sounds are from a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. These are the sounds of Star Wars. There's something about these sound effects that envelop you. It's not just the surround sound speakers, but you can feel their three-dimensionality and instantly know that you have been transported to another universe. Since the first Star Wars movie hit the theaters in 1977, movie soundtracks have not been the same. All these sounds and more have been collected for a new book and audio collection called The Sounds of Star Wars. It's written by J.W. Rinzler and with a foreword by the renowned sound designer Ben Burt. J.W. Rinzler and Ben Burt join us from the studios of Skywalker Ranch, appropriately, in Marin County, California. Gentlemen, thanks so much for making time for us.
Hello. Thank you for having us.
J.W., before Star Wars, most sci-fi film sound was electronic. Why wasn't George Lucas satisfied with that for Star Wars?
George Lucas wanted to depart from that direction of science fiction sonic world. He wanted his universe to sound real, kind of used, ordinary, if you might say, and very natural. So his suggestion was, well, don't go to your synthesizers first and generate echoing electronic tones for me, but rather go out into the real world with your tape recorder and record motors and animals and bring back familiar sounds which we can modify into something otherworldly.
And so, Ben Burt, what was the task put before you?
Well, I was given a Nagra tape recorder, which was a high-quality portable reel-to-reel machine, and told to go collect a library of sound.
And so where did you start?
Well, I started in my own apartment with the appliances, the blender in the kitchen, that sort of thing. I moved outward into the neighborhood, recording traffic through pipes under the freeway, and kept going until I found myself in the desert recording wild animals, bears and things at a ranch. I collected bits and pieces of sound from everywhere.
I think Darth Vader's breathing is, you know, something that it's a little like when music in a movie comes up and you know that the villain is coming. But this wonderful breathing sound, how did you get that?
At the time, the script described Vader as wearing some kind of life support suit that had machinery to keep him alive. And I went to a local scuba diving shop where they give lessons, and I just asked if I could go in the back room and record different scuba masks and regulators and things, and they said sure. So I just spent an hour or so back there trying out the different breathing apparatuses that were laying around, and ultimately that, which was me breathing, once brought back to the studio and slowed down a little bit, became the breathing of Darth Vader.
So it's your breath slowed down just a bit.
Yes, to give it a little more weight. You know, Vader is a much bigger character than I am, and also to give him sort of a massive feel.
R2-D2 sounds electronic, but he's got his language, his voice, his sound, I mean, whatever you call it. Was that a big challenge for you?
R2-D2 was the hardest task I had, the one that took me the longest. There wasn't any precedent in movies for a character like a robot that was to be so expressive but not use any words in English or any language. And I went to synthesizers at first, but the results sounded too much like a machine, just something cold. It didn't seem to have a soul. And after struggling for a long time and auditioning things, we found that in conversation, George and I were making verbal sounds to imitate what we thought the robot, you know, the intonation of the robot, making funny little whoop, whoop, yip, beep, whoop, doot, doot, this kind of thing. We kind of had this language. Then suddenly one day I realized, well, why don't we just do something like that? And so I began to make my own sounds. I found a way of performing them at the same time that I could work a keyboard on an ARP synthesizer. So that ended up being the recipe, which was kind of 50% electronic and 50% human. R2's voice was born.
But the scream, I think, of R2-D2, that was a once-in-a-lifetime scream.
Yeah, I screamed for that. I used to record. I had a room in George Lucas's house where their offices were, but I was down in the basement. So I would, when I wanted to record something, I didn't have a recording booth. I used to get under a big table down in the room where I worked and with a microphone and kind of curl up in the corner. And one day I just made a scream. I just screamed. Maybe there was some stress behind it, the whole thing, but that scream sped up. Was used pretty much straight up for R2-D2's scream.
I'm speaking with sound designer Ben Burt as well as author J.W. Rinzler about their book together, The Sounds of Star Wars. J.W., your book is so detailed, so much information about how the sounds were conceived and how they were made, but you can actually play the sounds and look at the pictures. Did you design this to appeal not only to Star Wars buffs, but, you know, a casual viewer?
Oh, definitely, yeah. This book is meant to appeal to anybody who's interested in cinema or sound. But I have to say the idea for it came from the packager, Becker and Mayer. They had just done a Birdsong book, and they came to us at Lucasfilm and said, you know, we think the technology is good enough so we could do a Sounds of Star Wars book. And then I contacted Ben, who is, I think, justifiably skeptical.
Yeah, I was worried that, you know, how would an explosion or something or one of the spaceships sound like played over a tiny speaker, and I wasn't sure.
And then Ben suggested that we include a earphone jack or stereo jack.
Yeah, the earphone jack is so kids can take the book to bed and get under the covers with their headphones and their parents won't know.
Mm. Yeah, and also it won't drive the parents crazy.
Yeah, in the back seat of the car.
Right? Yeah. One sound I have to ask you about, because it's one that's imitated so often, the lightsaber. You know?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, even the actors in the more recent Star Wars prequels found that when they were fighting on the set, they were making those sounds verbally, unconsciously, because they might have done it as boys from the original film. But the lightsaber sound was one of the first sounds. In fact, I think it really was the first sound that I made for Star Wars. I had kind of an immediate inspiration for it. I was a projectionist at that time at USC Cinema, and there's a motor in the projection booth. It had a humming sound when it just sat there idling. It had a very musical sound, a nice tone, almost a hypnotic tone. And I thought immediately that would be a good element for the lightsaber, so I recorded that motor. And a few weeks later, I had an accident with a broken microphone cable, and the microphone picked up hum from a nearby television. It had kind of a scintillating, angry buzz. Normally you'd throw that away thinking it was a mistake, but I saved that picture tube buzz, and I combined it with the sound of the projector motor, and the two sounds together became the basis for the sputtering hum of the lightsabers.
J.W. Rinzler, as the author of this Star Wars sound book, did you come to this as a fan? Is that why you wanted to do it?
I come to it as a person who just loves cinema. You know, I grew up with the Star Wars films, and I think they're among the best. But I just come at them hoping that people will learn about cinema with sort of Star Wars as the teaspoon full of sugar.
J.W. Rinzler is the author of the new book, The Sounds of Star Wars. Ben Burtt is the sound designer for the Star Wars movies and many other films. Both gentlemen joined us from Skywalker Ranch in Marin County, California. Thanks so much, and good luck with the book.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you can go to our website to hear how Ben Burtt made some of the other signature Star Wars sounds, like Death Star's Planet Annihilator Laser and the sonic signature of the Millennium Falcon. What about Chewbacca?
He's a bear.
He's a bear. That's what I thought.
Mostly a bear. Yeah, mostly a young bear.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen.
You only have to turn on the TV these days to wonder whether our culture has gotten a little bit narcissistic.
You think you're fascinating?
I think I'm fascinating, yeah.
You know, you coming home with me type of look.
I'm the eighth one of the world.
I'm like a Ferrari. I'm high maintenance, okay?
Okay. So most of those people are actually from one show, Jersey Shore. But whether those reality TV stars could be clinically diagnosed with narcissistic personality disorder, well, that's a matter of debate. The American Psychiatric Association recently announced that it may pull 5 personality disorders, including narcissistic personality disorder, from the highly influential Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. So what does the move tell us about our culture of me? We put the question to Dr. Keith Campbell. He heads the psychology department at the University of Georgia. He's also the co-author of a book, The Narcissism Epidemic. Campbell says in most cases, there's a difference between a clinical narcissist and one we watch on TV.
The thing that makes it clinical is when you go to the extreme where it's pervasive, where it affects all aspects of your life, not how maybe you act at work or you act in certain situations. You can't help yourself but trying to get attention or seek admiration, and where it interferes with your life, where it distorts your decision-making, it destroys your relationships. So when there's real pathology associated with it.
What are the other disorders that are under consideration to be dropped?
Currently, there are 10 personality disorders, and they're looking at dropping 5 of these. In addition to narcissism, there's dependent personality disorder, histrionic personality disorder, which is sort of being dramatic or outgoing, paranoid personality disorder, and schizoid personality disorder.
What's the thinking behind dropping them?
It's a complicated story. What we think with personality disorders is that they are a manifestation of normal personality. And so we should think about disorders the same way we think about normal personality, which is rather than being given a diagnosis that was a type, so you have narcissistic personality disorder, what they'd say is you have a combination of traits that maybe lie on a continuum or on a spectrum, and you have high levels of traits that are associated with narcissism.
So you could be told you're a little bit narcissistic.
Yeah, and you can. I mean, people clinically think of narcissism as a spectrum.
But how would it affect then the treatment of whatever, what disorder you may have?
You know, if you're treating somebody and it's more extreme or less extreme, the treatment's going to be very similar. There's no treatment for extreme narcissism that's somehow different than moderate levels of narcissism.
So it sounds like this change is really about the clinicians and the world of psychology than the rest of us, you know, sitting on the therapist's couch.
when this happened, I went and looked at Twitter just to see what people are saying about it. And the most common response was, it must be so normal now, it's no longer disorder. And the second most was, well, gee, I guess I'm okay then. So people see this narcissism everywhere, and they're just shocked that the disorder is being, or they're considering getting rid of it. It's such a perfect term for so much of what we see in society.
That's Dr. Keith Campbell, head of the psychology department at the University of Georgia and co-author of The Narcissism Epidemic. He spoke with us from the University of Georgia. Dr. Campbell, thanks for talking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.